This is the Marketplace Morning Report. I'm David Brancaccio. The biggest private hedge fund on Earth, and maybe the galaxy, is Bridgewater Associates. The Connecticut company has an intense corporate culture. Over the years, founder Ray Dalio and team have worked out algorithms for feedback so that investment strategies and management decisions can be questioned, pressure tested, and revised. Employees rate each other electronically. People earn points for knowing what they're talking about. Dalio has revealed Bridgewater's secrets of success in his new book called Principles, Life and Work. He came into the Marketplace New York Bureau to talk to us.
The basic thing that I learned is that I want to increase my probabilities of being right. And the way this stress testing works is in three steps. The first, you have to put your honest thoughts on the table. Can everybody do that? Second, you have to know the art of thoughtful disagreement. In other words, how do you listen? How do you take in? How do you exchange thoughts so that collectively you can get to a better place than you had individually? And then third, if you have disagreements, how do you resolve those disagreements in an idea meritocratic way, like we have believability-weighted decision-making? So by being able to stress test our thoughts, we're able to be successful. And you only need to do two things in life to be successful. The first is you have to know the right decisions to make, and the second is that you have to have the courage to make them.
Now, you learned the hard way that you had a tendency to get a big head full of your own unquestionable awesomeness?
Well, I don't know if it was the awesomeness. I did have way too much confidence relative to my humility. And, I think in one particular case, it was 1981, 82, and I had calculated that countries were going to default on their debts, and that turned out to be right. But
well, you went pretty public with it. I was reading that you were on Rukeyser on Friday night on PBS, and you didn't hedge your statements.
Right. You have to place bets, and so hedging is not what I don't want to equivocate, but I really did think that this collapse, which then happened, I got on TV because of anticipating it, and then I testified to Congress and all that, and I thought we were going to have a depression, and we had exactly the opposite. That was the bottom in the stock market, and we had one of the biggest bull markets ever. And I had a small company then. It was 7 years after I started Bridgewater. And I lost money for myself. I lost money for my clients. I had to let everybody go. I was down to me being the last employee, and also I had to borrow $4,000 from my dad to pay some bills. And it was one of the most painful experiences I had. But it turned out to be one of the best experiences I had. What it did is it changed how I thought completely. I went from thinking, thinking I'm right, to asking myself, how do I know I'm right? And that humility opened my mind and really allowed me to bring in people who had the greatest differences of views and triangulate. This process of triangulation with humility is an incredibly valuable process because the best ideas are not always going to be in your head and you'll learn so much more. So it just significantly raises the probability of being right if you can just sort of give it up.
Now, you raise this. I want to understand it better. The person who's asking questions of you or you're quizzing in this back and forth to try to test an idea, you say they have to be believable. What is that? They have to be able to back up with data what they say?
Well, no, let me give you a good example to put it in this way. Believability decision-making is very much like, let's say you're sick and you need to get a doctor and you want to find the best thing to do. Well, first of all, knowing that you don't know the best answer, even though it's your authority to do what you want with your body, you would be smart to say, I don't know the best answer. You'd be smart to triangulate. In other words, to try to find the best, maybe three or two people who are the best, who are willing to argue with each other. And then when you go through that argument and you listen to the backs and forth and so on, if they're triangulating, you can have a level of comfort to go forward that is better than you would have if you didn't do this. And if they're at odds, it'll surface the issues that need to be examined and resolved. And then when you get to the end of that process and you have to make a decision, you're going to consider their relative believabilities. So that's believability-weighted decision-making. Now how we come up with the believabilities is a whole other discussion that probably is too long for here. But we have processes in which all the people rate each other in terms of their believabilities. And then there are objective measures, like if you take a test, how did you do in that test? How did you do in the circumstances? So that we have people's believabilities for something like 50 different dimensions. You know, maybe your responsibility is to be a lawyer. Maybe your responsibility is to do something different. Some people are creative and some people are reliable. People are good and bad in different ways. And so by knowing what those are, and then actually to be able to go in and say, okay, now let's believability way to vote. So we created a technology that allows us in a group to say, okay, what would you now do? And we put it in and it calculates the believability weighted vote. And I know as a leader of the company or in any job that I have there, that if I know that there are other people who are more believable or it stacks up a certain amount, I'd be pretty stupid to just do what I think, and I'd be pretty stupid to treat all of those votes the same. So that's believability weighted decision making.
You're very big on surfacing conflicts, and this is, of course, anyone who's worked in any organization, they're out there. What is that like in practice? Like, you notice someone is not meeting your gaze, there's something going on, you don't let that go on at all.
The key is to be good with each other. One of the important elements here is it's an idea meritocracy in which our goal is to have meaningful work and meaningful relationships through radical truthfulness and radical transparency. If you're radically truthful with the other person and you believe that that other person's going to be truthful for you, while that may be difficult initially in that moment, it builds better relationships and it builds better quality work. And then if you're radically transparent with people so that they get to see things directly so that there's not spin, that really makes an idea meritocracy.
Part of that radical transparency is you keep close track of meetings over at Bridgewater, right?
What we do is we tape everything for everybody to see, pretty much.
Videotaping.
Well, some video, audio, and so on. The basic idea is that if everybody could see things directly, there can't be spin. So if you were to, I don't know, go into the meeting with Jim Comey and President Trump, and they had that meeting, and you were to see it, okay, then you would form your own opinions about that, and that would be so much richer. And then you have a quality conversation about that. And how should it be? And then you get to principles of what are the principles, are the right principles for handling that. That really creates an idea meritocracy, not the gossiping behind people's backs. When we have a rule, really, that you can't gossip behind people's backs because it's neither ethical or productive, right? First of all, in terms of ethics, maybe you're right, maybe you're not right about what you're saying to somebody, but it's a total waste of time. If you're talking to somebody, it's actually subversive. And the basic idea of our justice system is the person has the right to face their accuser. So to bring it out and to have a discussion is great. We've been doing this for 42 years. It's the reason behind our success. Where does our success come from? It is by having independent thinkers. And the idea meritocracy is the reason that such independent thinkers want to be there. Otherwise, you're going to have them kill each other or go someplace else.
But God, you have to have a thick skin, right?
Well, you get used to it. And what happens is there's a process. At first, intellectually, you ask yourself whether you want it. Like if I was going to say with you, we're going to enter a relationship, and I was going to say, okay, so what do you want to do with me? How should I be? Should I be straightforward or should I not? Intellectually, you would make those choices. Most people make those choices. And then they will recognize that there are two parts in our brain. There's the prefrontal cortex, thoughtful part of our brain that says yes. And then there's the amygdala, this part of our brain that says, ooh, that is difficult. And our backgrounds have not lent itself to that. So there's an adaptation process. And we find that about two-thirds of the people can get through over about an 18-month period, this way of operating. The interesting thing is we find that the struggles are less between ourselves, although there are some of those, and their two parts of their brain. So when they come into that moment where it's difficult, they find that their upper level them that we're talking about, that thoughtful part, is reflecting on their lower level them and how to handle it. And that exercise carries them through that. And then that gets, we call it sort of getting to the other side. It's when people can speak frankly and so on. And people worry about the other way. They don't want to go back to the other way. The reason they don't want to go back to the other way is, first of all, when you go back to a normal organization and you start to realize you don't know what the other people are really thinking and they're all talking behind your back, and when you have all that office politics, and that becomes something that becomes distasteful to people. And they also could be more themselves. In other words, they know what their strengths and weaknesses are, and they're in a position where the others will guardrail them. They don't have to pretend. And so they learn also about their weaknesses. Do you want to know about your weaknesses, or do you not want to know about your weaknesses? The person who comes there wants to know about their weaknesses because they can deal with them now. The success comes from either being able to change those weaknesses into strengths, or maybe more often and a lot easier is to have compensating ways of dealing with those weaknesses. For example, having somebody who is strong where you are weak and recognizing that you have those weaknesses so you can deal with it together. When they get to the other side, when they get that type of perspective, they don't want to come back. And they also have great personal relationships. That means like it's an extended family. Community is a very big influence in where people want to work. So we have a situation where a lot of people, it's not for, and for those it's for, they can't get anything that's quite like it.
I mean, once they're in into the organization and once they're acculturated, I mean, you must have a decent amount of turnover during that early period where people are trying to figure out if this is for them.
If I take the first 18 months, 2 years, we have something like 35% turnover. And that is even when we show them what it's like. It's like going into maybe an intellectual Navy SEALs and we say, we're going to get you fit and you're going to do all of that. And then so we prepare them. And then when they come in, it requires an adaptation. It's not like we're literally going to put them in pain or do them harm or anything. It is like, okay, can we then be really truthful and have that idea of meritocracy? But as they go through it, it's an adaptation.
You must wrestle with this. What if someone is not well suited for this system but might have other talents that could have been useful? In other words, it weeds out the people who can't handle your process, who might have other talents that's kind of a shame they're not with you.
Well, I think that's a simple question of, is that talent that I'm going to lose because they're not there something that means that we can't really be truthful with each other? So it forces us to think about what are our most fundamental values. Our principles are our values. So I couldn't be married to my wife. I couldn't have friendships in a number of ways unless I have two things, that they are reasonable with me and I am reasonable with them, and that they're considerate with me and I'm considerate with them. So reasonable means able to reason. When we have a disagreement, can you reason with me? Can I reason with you? And can we get past it? Or are we going to have a temper tantrum, kind of an emotional barrier? I'm not able to do that. And then consider it. So it's a fundamental, for me, necessity. And I would rather gather people around who are like that. What am I asking for? Radical truthfulness and radical transparency? I don't mean that it's 100% truthfulness or 100% transparency.
Yeah, no. Right, Ray? Because okay. If someone says to you, am I fat? One knows not to answer that with radical transparency and truthfulness.
If you were to ask me, am I fat? I would answer you honestly, okay? But I would do it in a way that I would hope would be helpful, okay? And you would know that I would mean it's helpful. But on the other hand, there are things that you don't have to be totally transparent about. There are subjects. We're not subject. We don't talk publicly about people's personal issues. There's times that there's conversations that are important. But it's there's a long way to go from a typical organization to a lot more transparency and a lot more truthfulness that gets you into an idea meritocracy. The reason I wrote the book is that it's very important at this stage in my life to help other people be successful. In other words, to make decisions well. And I learned these things. You know, I started off pretty much with nothing, and then I made a whole bunch of mistakes and so on. And I wrote down each principle, you know, when I would encounter something, rather than just making a decision, I wrote down my criteria for making the decision. And I found that enormously helpful because every one of those situations is going to come again. So by writing them down, we could also look at the logic of those decisions together. And in the investment area, we were able to convert those principles into algorithms. And we found that the compounding of that idea, meritocracy, was the reason for our success. So I want to pass it along. So that's why I wrote the book.
When you're trying to bring on the best talent, what's the best way to pursue that? My understanding from the book is it has a lot to do with who you choose to look for that candidate.
What we learned about people is that people see things radically differently, literally. If a meeting is taking place, if something is taking place, the way they process that, what they see, is totally different. So the important thing is to put them in contact with people who see the same way they do and put them in contact with people who see things totally differently from the way they see it, as well as doing some other testing of how people see things. So some people will see the big picture and some people will see detail. You know, some people are lateral, some people are linear, that kind of thing. So that's what we do. We have a process of helping people of that sort, help them through it, and then also putting them in contact with people who are exactly different, because the magic starts to come when people realize that those differences exist and are valuable and are not made uncomfortable by it. I gave 150 of our managers a Myers-Briggs test. We've given different types of
tests. It was a famous personality test.
Personality profile. And it described them very well. But in ways, when I read it, I said, wow, I really didn't believe people thought that way. We asked them to rate it, and they rated it on a scale of 1 to 5, and 85% were either a 4 or 5 that gave that description. And so now we understood that. They then radically changed how they dealt with each other because they could see how other people saw things differently, where before it was almost like they were a pain in the ass, that they would take a look at the other person and they would say, don't they get it? Don't they get it? Don't they get it? Where they're seeing different things. And they started to realize that those things are invaluable because when you're seeing the big picture and they're seeing the detail, you know, you need them and they need you. So by knowing those things and putting them together, it's important. So it's just as important to find people who see things similarly as well as differently. They're both important.
Does adhering to these principles slow down an organization? I mean, there's a certain amount of rigmarole here. And if we take you at your word, it's important rigmarole. But does it delay getting from problem to solution?
No. It speeds it up and it makes it more consistent. Think if you don't have some clarity of how you're going to behave with each other, you're going to have a lot of problems. Let me think about the presidential election by way of example. One person wins the majority of the votes. The other person wins the majority of the electoral votes. Now, if you didn't have a rule about how to deal with that circumstance so that you then got into a big argument of which should determine who should be the president of the United States, that's going to be a problem. Okay, so all sorts of problems. Where if you have procedures and rules that are clear that you agree on, it's going to expedite the process because you know how to handle such things.
So we had the procedure. It sped up the outcome. I mean, that could have been litigation until we all die, the presidential election.
Right. As I say, I think you have to have three things. You have to have the ability to put your honest thoughts on the table. You have to have thoughtful disagreement. And you have to have processes for getting around it. The reason there are a few hundred principles in the book, sounds like a lot, is because there are a few hundred different things that one encounters. Every time a certain type of thing was encountered, I wrote and we discussed and we agreed on what are our principles for doing that. And so it has a granularity And because it's done idea meritocratically, in other words, people agree that those are the principles we're to live by, it makes things go better, and it also speeds things along once you get there.
And you're working on an app, some sort of digital assistant that would help a person navigate these?
Yeah, we have an app, which we call a coach, and it operates like a coach. A coach would be almost like your GPS.
And that's the internal one for Bridgewater, but
yeah.
Might this ever be outward-facing
and
I could buy
well,
it?
What I'd like to do is pass all of this along, and we'll do that in the not-too-distant future in some way that I haven't quite figured out.
The book is about principles, but at the public policy level, you've written, democracies are healthy when the principles that bind people are stronger than those that divide them. By that measure, how's our democracy doing in America these days?
I think we're in the process of finding that out. We have divisions, deep divisions. Those are economic and they're in values. If you look at the economy of the bottom 60%, that's the majority of the people. It should be looked at separately from the economy as a whole. Averages are misleading. The top 0.1% of the population's net worth is greater or equal to the bottom 90% combined. And so there are different worlds out there. The world you and I are living in, maybe, not the same as that other world. I think what Donald Trump did a very good job of doing was to tap into that world and to bring it to the surface. We're now talking about that kind of a world. Now, that one goes back to history. This reminds me also economically, very similar to 1937. 1937 was after we had a debt crisis and they printed money, bought financial assets, and we were at a time in the cycle where the central bank began its first tightening and everything was sensitive and that there was a wealth gap and that conflict was a problem. So the issue is really how conflict will be handled. Will we be brought together and work together on this, or will we be divided? And that's why I think we must not have an economic downturn now. In other words, if you're going to err on the side of it, for the economy as a whole, this is called good. This is really good. The lowest unemployment rate, stock market's high, this is when good. But you could see the tensions that lie beneath it. And so we must not have an economic downturn now. That has to do with monetary policy. I won't get into the monetary policy. But
also social policy
social
and these
policy.
Tensions you're talking about.
So I think that's the biggest issue of our time. I believe everything happens over and over again. And when one looks at it, you say, what one of those is it? Everything's another one of those. And what one of those is it? What species is it? And you have to look at other past species to make that assessment. And then you have to have principles for dealing with those. And this one is a situation that's somewhat like the 1937 type of period. It's a period in which how we are bound by our principles or how they divide us and how conflict is handled is of paramount importance.
Now, remind me just briefly because we're going to wrap this up. 1937. There was more depression to go after that.
Well, what happened was when interest rates hit zero, the central bank bought a lot of financial assets, printed money, essentially, and the balance sheet went up. And as a result of putting liquidity, the stock market and assets went up, and interest rates went close to zero. And then the economy started to turn up a bit, and then they tightened slightly. At the same time, during that recovery, like now, the wealth gap widened, and it was very large. And beneath the surface lied conflict. And then they hired populist leaders. This was a world phenomenon. Leaders who will fight for one side and against another, tending to be strong personalities who are more inclined to have conflict.
We know what that looked like in Europe, yes.
Yes. So it doesn't mean that we're destined to do anything like that. But I think when we use the term populist and we have leaders and we think of conflict and we think of wealth gaps and we think of sensitivity to interest rate changes and we think of levels of indebtedness and so on, there are analogous circumstances then that are similar to now, and we should be mindful of those.
Ray Dalio founded Bridgewater Associates, which has the very biggest hedge fund. His book, one word, is called Principles. Mr. Dalio, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.